Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of April. This hour of the program, we're going to be concentrating on the nation's toughest bill on illegal immigration. It went into law on Friday when it was signed by Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona. It is to identify and to prosecute and deport illegal immigrants. This is an issue that, of course, is highly contentious in the country. Mexico's foreign minister said that it was worried about the rights of its citizens and relations with Arizona. The Cardinal of Los Angeles said that it was like being in a Nazi state. There are court challenges that have been filed pretty immediately, and there's some question about whether or not this will be going into law. It all underscores, as the New York Times article stated, the power of the immigration debate in states along the Mexican border. And we're going to be looking at why this bill, the problems with immigration, whether or not the federal government needs to take up this issue, and sooner rather than later. We have two guests with us, and I'm sure that we're going to have many phone calls. Our guests are Stephen Camarota, who is with the Center for Immigration Studies, where he's director of research. He's been with the center for, since 1996, and his area of expertise is economics and demographics. He has his PhD from the University of Virginia in public policy analysis and also studied at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Camarota, thank you very much for being with us today. It should be an interesting hour. Hello. Hello, Professor. Are you there?
Are you looking for Steve Camarota?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't quite hear you. This is Steve Camarota. Hello.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay, great. Also joining our conversation is Professor Yale Lohr. He is one of the country's preeminent authorities on U.S. immigration and asylum law. He's a prolific scholar, has written many law review articles, and is author or co-author of four standard reference works. He's a professor of law at Cornell University. Professor Yale Lohr, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Well, let's look at this law. It has been called the most stringent bill on immigration in the country. How stringent is it?
Well, certainly the most stringent state law that's been enacted. It's wide-ranging. A lot of people have been focusing on just a few provisions, but it also covers a lot of other things like employer sanctions and smuggling. And it's going to take a long time for the courts to sort out whether all or parts of it are unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so tell us about those parts we don't know very much about.
It says, for example, that if you're undocumented in the United States and you solicit work, that you could be charged with a misdemeanor under Arizona law. It also says that local employers have to verify through electronic means that they have hired people legally. It also makes it unlawful to pick up passengers for work. And if you do so, that's a Class 1 misdemeanor now under state law. So there's a lot here that people will have to digest.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the law overall? Is it too tough, Professor Camarota, or not?
Probably the overall effect is relatively modest. The main parts of the law that have gotten most of the attention, I think, and rightly so. Remember, Arizona already had a requirement that employers had to use the E-Verify system to verify that new workers were legally in the country. So that was already there if you wanted a business license in Arizona. But the two parts of it, I think, that or the two issues that are, I think, most concern are the question of preemption. Does the law preempt federal law? And here it probably doesn't, in the sense that it just basically says that federal law requires non-citizens to register with the government and carry their documents. And if they don't do it, they're in violation of federal law. And the Arizona law just says if you don't do it, you're also in violation of Arizona law. So it just mirrors the federal law. The other issue that is big, or bigger, is potentially, the civil rights issues. Will the police only target Hispanics? The government estimates that about 80% of illegals in the country are from Latin America. So you can see why that concern, then, that the police might use race or ethnicity as the sole means, you know, by which they then ask about immigration status. So that's the main concern, I think, for most folks.
Yeah, how do you deal with that, Professor Yale Lohr? This has received a lot of attention, but if you're just looking at somebody, how do you know that they're in the United States unauthorized?
That's a very good question, and I think it could lead to racial profiling. The law does say that the cops in Arizona cannot use one of the following factors, race, color, or national origin by itself, in determining whether someone may be here illegally. But certainly they can combine that with other factors, and there's a lot of case law on immigration stops and searches in other contexts at the federal level, and the court said this is a very difficult analysis, and there's no clear precedent about what constitutes a reasonable suspicion in one factual context versus another. So I think that depending on how it's enforced, there could be problems with this law.
Mm-hmm. The governor of the state of Arizona said, you know, we have to do something because the federal government is really slow here on this issue. They need to deal with it. Would you agree, Professor Camarota, is the federal government needing to step in right now?
Well, I think everybody would agree that they're dissatisfied with the status quo with immigration. Those who tend to obviously identify with the employers of the illegal immigrants or with the illegal immigrants themselves tend to favor the idea of a legalization or an amnesty for the illegals. And those who tend to, say, be more concerned about the cost to taxpayers or the competition with American workers or the rule of law just more generally, they tend to say, well, look, no, we should enforce the law and encourage as many illegal immigrants to go home as possible. And so everybody agrees the status quo is bad. It's where the issue breaks down, where the agreement breaks down is, yeah, but how do we move off the status quo? What is it that we're going to do? Everybody knows the federal government isn't doing that much to enforce the law in many important respects, whether it's at the border, keeping track of temporary visitors, going after the employers who hire illegals, and so forth. But the problem is, or the issue, the question is, if everyone's dissatisfied with the status quo and we all agree that we're going to have to do more to enforce the law, other than that, though, what else do you want to do? How do you want to deal with people here? What do you want to do with future flows? And all this is so contentious that it's been very difficult for Congress to fashion something that can make it through Congress at this point. So states like Arizona are confronted with a large illegal population, maybe 500,000 illegal immigrants in the state, roughly speaking, based on the last government estimate. The number is down maybe by 100,000 from where it was at a peak in 2008. It's down to under 500,000, according to the 2009 estimates the government puts out. But, you know, it's still a very big and contentious issue. Just to give you an example, one-third of the uninsured in Arizona are illegal immigrants, that is, those without health care. The state is probably spending about $2 billion a year educating children from illegal families. So these are big issues in Arizona.
Professor Yale Lohr, how would you move? How do you think we need to move off the status quo, if at all?
Well, I think we need to have comprehensive immigration reform in Congress. And I think that although there certainly an adverse impact at the local and state level, particularly in states along the borders because of immigration, at a federal level, the federal government does well by immigration overall. A 1997 National Academy of Studies study, National Academy of Sciences study, found that immigration overall is a net economic benefit to the United States. The problem is that the taxes are going to Washington but are not flowing back to the states from Washington. So we need to correct that as part of comprehensive immigration reform.
What would happen if we just let everybody in who wanted to come here?
Oh,
well,
we can't do that.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Who's the question for? I'm sorry.
Either one of you, both of you.
Well, yeah, let me show you how contentious this is. The National Academy of Science study said that if you allow that all immigrants, not just the illegals, but all immigrants at the time, should, the economy's much larger, but the benefit to native-born Americans was relatively small, about 0.2% of GDP. So they were estimating anywhere from $1 to $10 billion gain in incomes for native-born Americans, but there were two catches to that. Although there was a $1 to $10 billion gain from immigration economically, they estimated a $10 to $20 billion fiscal drain overall. That is, when you look at the taxes, immigrants pay and the services they use. So the fiscal drain was larger than the economic drain. Also, the other thing about immigration that that study estimated is that immigration had a significant adverse effect on the wages of the poorest 10% of native-born Americans, reducing their wages about 5%, or accounting for about 44% of the overall decline in their wages in the preceding two decades. So basically, they said most Americans gain, but they lose it all when it comes to tax payments, and the poor are made poor. However, the immigrants are made much better by coming here, and that's also something to think about. And that's so you can see why those kinds of results, if you're concerned about taxpayers, immigration generally, though it didn't deal with illegal immigrants, is kind of bad. If you're concerned about, say, you know, returns on capital, then immigration looks good. If you're concerned about the poor in the United States, immigration looks bad. If you're concerned about the immigrants, and that's a big focus, the immigrants do benefit by coming here, so immigration looks good. So these are the kinds of choices you're going to have to make when you think about immigration. There, it's not all bad. It's not all good. There's no such thing as a public policy that is, we'll call it phantasmagorical, where everybody wins. There are clear losers from immigration and clear winners. Mm. Now, we can debate who they are, but we can't think of it as all costs and all benefits. It just doesn't work that way.
What do you think of what he just said, Professor Yale-Lohr?
I agree there are costs and benefits, and we need to fine-tune our immigration system so that overall it does benefit our economy. I personally believe, for example, we need more economic immigrants because they stimulate the economy. It's estimated that 25% of new startups are started by immigrants, and those are where a lot of new jobs are created. So in terms of getting us out of this recession, I think immigration at the high end can actually help all workers, both immigrant workers and native-born workers. There are some immigrants who come in on other ways that, you know, maybe we need a few less of those. For example, we have a diversity program that allows 50,000 people a year to come in simply because we have a lottery. I don't think that's in our national interest, and I would say that when we do reform, comprehensive immigration reform, we should probably get rid of that particular diversity green card lottery program.
There has been some mention of programs like NAFTA that have not been beneficial to people in countries like Mexico, Latin American countries, and they have come here because their jobs have folded in their native-born areas. Would you agree that that's been a problem and that we need to look at those trade agreements as we take on the issue of immigration?
Well, the hope of NAFTA was that it would stimulate job and wage growth in Mexico in a way that then would, over time, reduce migration pressures. And people who tend to like free trade will point to the economic gains for the United States and Mexico that came from NAFTA, but there were things about NAFTA that didn't play out the way we anticipated. There just wasn't enough higher wage job growth in manufacturing, partly because China came online and outcompeted Mexico to some extent. Also, the way in which development occurred in Mexico, such a large fraction of it along the U.S.-Mexico border, it tended to lead people that, well, if you move from the interior to Mexico to double your wages by coming to the border, why not triple them by going over the border? So, unfortunately, there was that, which may or should have perhaps been foreseen, so there was that. The other way in which NAFTA both benefited and harmed Mexico. Here we're back to benefits and cost again. A lot of U.S. grain flowed into Mexico, and this was an enormous benefit to the urban poor in Mexico who could now buy some foodstuffs at cheaper prices in many cases. However, it was also very tough on Mexican agriculture, who now had to compete with the highly mechanized U.S. grain production. So it's one of those kinds of things. So did NAFTA spur a lot of new immigration? The thing of it is that the Mexican-born population in the United States, we're just going to focus on Mexico, in 1970 was about 800,000. By 1980, 10 years later, it was over 2 million. And by 1990, before NAFTA, it was about 4 million. So it had been growing very rapidly prior to NAFTA, and it just continued after NAFTA. So it's kind of hard when there's a lot of debate about what impact NAFTA ultimately had. It created winners and losers in Mexico, and It's a tough question to know whether it made the migration problem worse or lessened it.
What do you think, Professor Yale-Lohr?
I agree with that. It is complex. And I think, for example, Mexicans also vote with their feet. With this great recession, we've seen that the number of people in the United States from other countries has declined. So I think that people decide for economic reasons where their best opportunities are. And for a lot of Mexicans who can't make a living in the interior of Mexico, the United States presents a better opportunity. NAFTA, as Steve Camarada just pointed out, was supposed to address that, and it has only partially. We need to go back and try to develop a better long-term foreign policy with Mexico so that over the long term, more Mexicans will decide that their better economic future lies in Mexico, not the United States.
Mm-hmm. Can I make one very quick comment? But I do think that it's important to understand that our ability as Americans to shape events in Mexico is limited. We shouldn't imagine, and I'm not suggesting my colleague here is saying that we can fix Mexico, but Mexico, and there's a whole literature on this, has a series of problems with corruption and transparency and a whole host of other issues that ultimately it's up to Mexico to address. We can be helpful, but the fact is, conditions in Mexico will largely develop outside of our control. We have to just recognize the limits of our own ability to do something in other countries. Remember, we've been in occupation of Iraq, for nearly a decade, and we're dissatisfied with all kinds of aspects of their development. And so we have to recognize the limits.
We're going to welcome phone calls on this issue, and we're going to take them in just one moment. We're looking at immigration reform and the controversial immigration bill in Arizona, looking at details of that bill and also asking whether or not the federal government needs to step in and start doing something on immigration reform. The reasons that they may be holding back on doing just that is forthcoming in our discussion. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address, we already have a couple of those in, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guests are Professor Stephen Yale Lohr, Adjunct Professor of Law at Cornell University, and Stephen Camarota, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Man, you guys have just hit just about every issue that I was thinking of about this, and it's just so complicated. And my view that I wanted to call about was that I'm so torn about this issue. I used to teach foreign languages, and I speak Spanish, and I like the Spanish-speaking culture. And I, about the bill, I think the potential for racial profiling is terrible, and the idea that citizens have to carry their documents on them, I think that's terrible. On the other hand, I know you cited those statistics about economic benefits to people who live here, but I know so many people in trade unions who can't get work anymore because companies that employ illegal immigrants can bid so low on the projects. And I don't know where you're saying, I don't know where that study gets the statistics, because it seems to me that wages have gone way down as a result of massive immigration.
Well, the National Academy of Sciences didn't necessarily disagree with you on that. You could have a situation in their analysis where wages decline for working class people significantly, but higher income people gain, and the overall gain is positive, and that's the sort of thing that immigration tends to do, what you describe. And so you have to decide how you feel about that. If immigration lowers wages for working class people and raises wages for people with a college degree, but you could argue then if the gain for the natives who have a college degree is in the aggregate larger than the loss for people who have the lower income, less educated, you could still say that there's a net gain, even if it did make the poor or the working class poor. I mean, I come down probably closer to your opinion that the National Academy of Sciences underestimated the negative wage impact. But remember, if immigration lowers wages at the bottom end, those wages don't vanish into thin air. They can either be retained by employers in the form of higher profits, and some of that go on, or they can be passed on to consumers. Immigration the effect on natives is generally redistributive, taking income away from lower income people and giving it to higher income, more educated people. And you have to decide, and the immigrants themselves, most of the larger economic activity goes to the immigrants themselves in the form of wages and benefits. So these are some of the trade-offs. If you're very concerned about working class people, you don't want to let in a lot of unskilled immigrants. our legal immigration system, the new immigrant survey shows that, you know, a third of new legal immigrants may not have a high school education as far as we can measure it. And of illegal immigrants, we think maybe a majority don't have a high school education. So the big effect is at the bottom end, you know, for roofers and tilers, people who do drywall and people who are nannies, maids, and busboys and meat packers. There, yeah, it should lower wages, partly because you're increasing the supply of workers and partly because maybe the immigrants, for whatever reason, might be willing to work for less in some cases.
Sarah, the other thing you have to remember is that we need to enforce our labor laws equally and vigorously. We have laws on the books already to make sure that everyone's supposed to get paid the same. We have the Fair Labor Standards Act that says every person, even an undocumented person, you know, has to be paid at least the minimum wage. So if we enforced our current immigration and labor laws more equally and vigorously, then there would not be as much of an incentive for an employer to hire an undocumented immigrant over a native U.S. worker. So I think we need to have more enforcement of our existing laws so we prevent that kind of enticement of employers to hire someone that they shouldn't hire otherwise.
Is there any enforcement of those laws now?
Sure, there's enforcement, but unfortunately, it's not as much enforcement as possible. It costs money to enforce any immigration or labor law, and it seems to be have been a lower priority to enforce the existing laws in the past. Now, with the Obama administration, they are increasing enforcement, but it remains to be seen whether it will be effective or whether most employers will think that it's worth the potential cost of getting caught if they can hire someone for a few dollars less per hour.
Thank you, Sarah, for your call. Virginia from Janesville is our next caller. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I believe there is a terrible cost to this country in illegal immigration, which is never talked about, and that is with the rise of agribusiness. 40% of the workers in the dairy industry are now at least we can say Mexican. We don't know how many of those are illegal. And my whole point is we look at the egg factories, we look at the meat packing factories, we look at the feedlots. Conditions are never going to improve in those occupations if they can import slave labor to keep those conditions exactly the way they are now. And those conditions are affecting the health of everybody in this country. So as long as we can keep importing people who will work in inhuman conditions, we're going to have agribusiness and animals treated horribly and health consequences to us all.
Professor Yale-Lohr, you want to start?
Sure. I think that is a cost, and I think it's a question of the U.S. consumer wanting low-priced, you know, goods and meat. And because we want low prices, that put pressure on employers to try to have low-cost help produce and cut those chickens and grow that corn and everything. And I think we, as a society, have to decide whether we want to have higher-cost food so that we can treat the workers in agribusiness at a better wage and treat them more humanely. And that's a policy question that we all have to face.
Here's an email that's come in. Let me just move this forward. I applaud the state of Arizona for taking a tough stand on the flood of illegals coming into this country. Washington has dragged its feet for too long on this issue and has done very little. People who are here legally and have the proper documentation have nothing to fear from this law. It's those who are illegal, and that's the purpose of this law. For those who are crying racial profiling here, let's be honest, the biggest problem is with illegals crossing over from Mexico. If you talk to a vast majority of Americans, I think you will find across-the-board support for what the state of Arizona is doing. Do you think so, Stephen Camerota?
Well, here's the way you have to understand the politics of immigration. Immigration is not a typical issue. It's not a left-right issue. It doesn't divide, Democratic, Republican. The main divide in America on immigration, and your emailer touched on it, is not so much that way, but rather between what might be called opinion leaders or elites on the one hand and common and regular folks on the other, so that public opinion, generally speaking, wants the law enforced, wants illegals to go home, and wants overall immigration to come down. And elites in the United States, whether they be journalists, college professors, editorial page writers, and there's some great survey work on this, heads of churches, heads of unions, heads of businesses, what might be called the opinion leaders. The Chicago Council on Foreign Relations does some great survey work in this area. They actually do these surveys periodically, ask the public one set of thing and the opinion leaders another, and typically immigration is the issue on which the American people versus its leaders divide the most profoundly. This is what creates the political stalemate here in Washington, because on the one hand, every single major interest group here in Washington that weighs in on the subject, everyone basically, wants the illegal immigrants legalized. They actually want legal immigration increased, and the deal is, but we promise this time we'll enforce the law. The public doesn't believe the law is going to be enforced, generally doesn't like the idea of legalization, and wants legal immigration cut generally too in surveys. And so this problem, when the interest groups weigh in, the bill kind of moves forward. Soon as public opinion becomes animated, as it did in 06 and especially in 07, the bill stops and nothing happens, and we get this stalemate. Or put a different way, interest group pressure is enough to make sure the law is generally not enforced, but it's not enough to make sure the illegal immigrants get their amnesty. On the other hand, public opinion is strong enough to prevent the amnesty, but it's not enough to make sure the law gets enforced. So if that helps your listener think about this issue and why it's so hard to come to an answer.
And also toss in then, if you would please, Professor Yalor, is the growing Hispanic Latino population in this country and the fact that they are being courted by both Republicans and by Democrats, and so it makes it a fairly tricky political issue.
Very tricky. Just in the last couple of days, for example, Senator Harry Reid, who is facing a tough re-election fight in Nevada, has decided to put immigration reform higher up on the political agenda in Washington than it had been otherwise, because he feels he needs the votes of those Hispanics in Nevada to help him get reelected. And as Steve Camerota pointed out, it's not a left-right Republican-Democrat divide. For example, some Republicans in Florida have denounced the Arizona law, saying it's not good. At least it's not wise public policy. So you see the politicians are trying to decide where they stand on immigration, both for short-term gain and in terms of the longer-term national interest.
Ron from Sparta, our next caller. Hi, Ron.
This is Bob.
This is Bob?
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. I pushed the wrong button. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, good morning. You know, something on this whole immigration issue that we need to understand. First of all, you know, other than the indigenous tribes in this country, every man, woman, and child is either an immigrant or a direct descendant of an immigrant. Everyone. Being first-generation American, this issue just boils me. You know, my parents came from Eastern Europe, grandparents, the entire family. 1957, got off the boat at Ellis. All the I's were dotted, T's were crossed, health checks done, background checks done, and sponsors in place. This is the way immigration is supposed to be done. We have hordes of people walking across our border. We don't know who they are. We don't know what they're bringing with them. We don't know anything about them. Yet we allow this. The word immigrant in this day has become so convoluted that the average person obviously does not understand there's a difference between immigrant and illegal alien. And an illegal alien is a person who has violated our borders, broken our laws. They are criminals and should be dealt with as such. People who facilitate the movement of illegal aliens are criminals and should be dealt with as such. People who knowingly hire illegal aliens are criminal and should be dealt with as such. This problem needs to be addressed in a huge way. I applaud Arizona. I hope every...
Whoops. I don't know what happened. Whoa. I'm not sure what happened to your phone line there, but I think we lost our guest in that, too. Stephen Camerota is... But we got the gist of what you were saying, that's for sure. And let's go to you with the first response on this, Professor Stephen Yalor.
Yes, everyone is an immigrant, and we do need to enforce our laws on the books better. But we have plenty of laws on the books already, and those, if they were enforced adequately, would be sufficient. We don't need states trying to interfere with what is ultimately a federal responsibility. For example, Wisconsin cannot declare war on Canada. That's just not something that a state can do. So, too, immigration is really a federal responsibility. And as much as I dislike the fact that Washington is not doing as much as it should on immigration, that does not give Arizona or some other states or localities the right to try to step in. We need to put the pressure on Washington to reform our immigration laws. It doesn't help to have states have a patchwork of differing immigration laws.
You know, some of this may be influenced by this documentary that I did way back in high school. I lived in Illinois, and I did a documentary on migrant workers who were from Mexico who were working in Chicago. There were then fields in Chicago, and the conditions were deplorable. And ever since then, I've wondered about the human part of this issue, and I don't think it can be ignored that there are people who are coming here who are risking their lives. Many of them have died along the border, who are coming here because they want a better life. You know, it's part of the American dream. You come here and you make more money and you send it back to your family, and there are opportunities here. There's a kind of vitriol about all of this that I don't quite understand, because the motivations for many people are really quite admirable, and a lot of these people work pretty grungy jobs, very hard. Can you put that factor into this, please?
Sure. I think that is a real issue. I think many of us have relatives or ancestors who came here even illegally, just because they wanted a better life. And that's how the United States has been able to be so successful, because we tolerate diversity and initiative and people willing to work hard. At the same time, we need to make sure that we enforce our laws correctly, so that everyone has an equal possibility of advancing in the United States. And when the laws are not enforced equally, so that employers say or feel that there is an incentive to hire someone illegally at a lower wage rather than someone legally at a correct wage, then that really makes it harder for immigrants to succeed, makes them a second-class citizen, and it really hurts native-born workers as well, too. So I think that if we realized we're all basically here for the same reason, we want to do better, and we try to make sure that we do better in an equal way, we'd all be better off both morally and legally.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure all that you heard, Stephen Camerota, about from the last caller. I think you heard the gist of it.
Yes.
What about the fact that we aren't really cracking down on everybody who's involved here, all of this illegal behavior?
Well, look, I mean, I think the caller has a point, and that's what is reflected in the Arizona law. Most of the border still does not have fencing and barriers. There are more New York City transit cops than there are Border Patrol agents on duty at any one time. We have a Treasury Department that issues regulations saying illegal aliens can open bank accounts. We have states that purposely give driver's licenses to illegal aliens. We have states that give in-state college tuition to illegal aliens. We have counties and governments in the United States that explicitly say they won't cooperate with immigration authority. We issue millions of time-limited visas a year and entries into the United States, and then don't keep track of whether the time limit has ever been honored. The list goes on and on of all the things that aren't done to enforce the law. So, yeah, I mean, the caller has a point. Now, the fundamental question we have to decide is, how many people do we want to come in? And then what selection criteria? Right now, we're allowing over 1 million people to settle permanently in the United States each year. That's the so-called green card. We obviously allow, you know, tens of millions of short-term tourist visitors, but in addition to the 1.1 million green cards, we allow more than 500,000 people into the United States each year on a long-term temporary basis, guest workers, foreign students, cultural exchange, that sort of thing. So these are big numbers, but what you have to recognize is the desire to come to the United States remains vast in the world, and it's much greater than anything that most Americans would want in terms of what they think we can, you know, the absorption capacity of the United States. So, for example, surveys in Mexico suggest that about half of Mexico's population would, when asked by several surveys, show that half said, yeah, I'd like to move to the United States if I could. And that was even true of college graduates in Mexico.
And there are lots of places where, you know, countries like India, you know, maybe a fifth of the population responds that way. Now, would all those people move here if they could? Not. But the desire to come here is in the hundreds of millions in a world of 6.5 billion people. So that's the dilemma. You have to decide. And just legal immigration that we're taking in right now will add over the next, say, 50 years, maybe 54 years, about 70 million new people to the U.S. population. That is the people who will come plus their descendants. Now, how do you feel about that? Well, if you're very concerned about the environment and pollution and congestion, 70 million people might not seem like a very good idea. On the other hand, if you say, well, I think an even bigger population will create more opportunities for businesses, then you would say, well, that sounds great. Let's do that. So these are the choices. But like on so many issues, we seem unable to make the choices. What do we want to emphasize and then implement that policy? It seems very hard.
We're talking about immigration in this country this hour of the program, prompted by the controversial bill passed by the governor last Friday. There are lawsuits that have been filed immediately challenging that law and some questions about the constitutionality of the law as well. It prompts the question, should we not be dealing with this issue on a national level right now? We have two guests with us. Our guests are Stephen Camarada. He is a director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies. Professor Stephen Yale Lohr is adjunct professor of law at Cornell University. And we have one line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Lots of emails coming in. We'll get to a couple more of those in a moment. That's talk at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take a couple emails now, gentlemen. This one comes from Jerianne in South Milwaukee regarding enforcement of existing laws. Doesn't enforcement rely on complaints that the laws are being violated? My question is, who's going to complain? Would that have to be primarily those who feel like they are being wronged, such as the workers who aren't being paid the prevailing or minimum wage? If they're in the country illegally, wouldn't they risk being deported if they file a complaint?
Well, yes, that is a concern. That the people who do step forward, if they are themselves undocumented, could be deported. And in the Arizona State example, it doesn't require a complaint if the officer has a reasonable suspicion that someone is not here legally. They themselves have to determine their immigration status. So it depends on which kind of law, federal or state, you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Camarada?
I'm not sure if this, deals with the current law. I mean, this law in Arizona. If you're worried about sort of enforcement of workplace laws, then that's one of the concerns with having a large illegal workforce is that they can't complain as easily. Though I should tell you that the sociological research on this question of whether illegal immigrants come in and work for less than comparably educated native-born Americans is mixed. I could run through that for you. Clearly, it happens in specific circumstances. But probably the main effect that immigration has on wages is simply by significantly increasing the supply of labor. Let me just, you know, give you a quick example. Somewhere around a third of all people who work in meatpacking are foreign-born. Now, even if they were all legal, you would guess that if you increase the supply of workers, you would exert a lot of downward pressure on wages of people in the meatpacking industry, again, regardless of legal status. In contrast, about 5% of lawyers and attorneys in the United States are foreign-born, so their immigration would have very little impact on wages. And so that's the way you probably need to think about the issue of immigration.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Patty from Eau Claire. Hi, Patty.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
You know, this issue, I get so emotional about this issue, and I'm a fairly liberal thinker, but I get very protective of the country with this, and I guess part of it is it really makes me mad that we're always putting the quote, punishment on the immigrant and not the employers. And that really bothers me. I think that if they're hiring illegals, then they need to get in trouble. But on the other hand, it bothers me that there are so many immigrants that come here looking for the quote, American dream, which the country can't sustain, and then seem to demand, you know, I live in, you know, rural Wisconsin, and we've got a Hmong population that and going to the public schools, well, these teachers don't know how to communicate with them. And to use public dollars to accommodate all these people, we just can't do it. To me, the immigrant, legal immigrant community needs to take responsibility for those kinds of things so that they can, if I go to Italy, I don't expect everybody to speak English. I have to bring my Italian dictionary and learn this, you know, stuff. And the other thing about jobs is, you know, there's lots, you know, we have some wonderful Mexican restaurants in town. You never see anybody other than their family and other Mexicans working in those. They don't post we're hiring and take others in for employment. And so I just have some issues like that that really bother me, and I hope I don't sound too petty, but if you could address those on that kind of gut level. I'd...
All right, let's start with Professor Yale Lohr.
Yeah, Patty, in terms of one aspect of your statement about Hmong in rural Wisconsin, again, that shows the disconnect between federal and state responsibilities here. We have a refugee policy that says, as a federal matter, that we want to help protect people who are persecuted overseas, who will bring them in as refugees. And that's a federal statement that we've made. But when we bring them to the United States, unfortunately, we don't give them or give states or localities enough money to provide them training or education or language skills or provide ESL teachers to properly educate these refugees from other countries. The money needs to be allocated more appropriately from the federal government to take care of these kinds of refugees. In terms of your statement about why is it that immigrants are not hiring native workers to work in their Mexican restaurants, et cetera, that's a sociological issue that happens in all areas and occupations of life. People tend to hire people like them, whether they're immigrants or native-born workers, and that's something that no law is really going to change.
Let's go next to John from Milwaukee. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
One of the problems that exists in the government today is the problems in Social Security. And when FDR originally set up Social Security, it had a flow of money coming in from the younger workers and a flow of money going out to the retirees. One of the problems in Social Security that exists is that we have a big bulge on the retiree end that they call the baby boom. And one of the solutions, it's not the total solution, is through immigration. We need to increase immigration and allow people on the younger end of the work scale to come into the United States and start building up that end of Social Security so that there's funding on the other end of Social Security. And the government, the federal government, needs to make people aware that immigration is a way to help our elders.
Well, this is an issue I've done a lot of my research on. It's at our website, cis.org. And the caller is right, but only a little. The best research shows that at most, if you were to project out over 50 years or 75 years, the current level of immigration, which had been running at about 1.5 million new legal and illegal immigrants a year, can offset the aging in the United States by maybe 10%, maybe 20% at most, depending if you change your assumptions. The reason is immigrants aren't that much younger than the average American when they arrive, and although they tend to have somewhat more children, the number of children they have just isn't that different. So you're not going to be able to fix or make a really big impact on Social Security, on Medicare, by adding immigrants. The other problem is that if you really wanted to do that, not only would you have to quadruple or quintuple the number of immigrants before you could even have any impact, but the other problem is the immigrants are too low income. As I indicated, we think that about a third of immigrants in the United States, based on the American Community Survey, the current population survey, don't even have a high school education. And Social Security is somewhat redistributive, paying out more generous benefits to low-income people as it is, and the low-income people pay less. So it's very hard to fund our modern welfare state with low-income immigrants. And there's just the basic demographic fact that here's one way to think about it in terms of fertility. There's a lot of research on this. Overall fertility is 2.1 in the United States. The average woman has 2.1 children, which is really the long-term thing that causes aging, depending on how many kids you have overall in this society. If you take out all the immigrants from the data and recalculate that fertility figure, it's 2.0. Immigration does raise fertility in the United States, but only a little. There's just not enough immigrants, they don't have enough kids, and they age like everybody else. So we can't use immigration to fix Social Security. It's not mathematically or demographically possible.
Well, it is if you choose the age of the immigrants as they come in, and you have on a federal level the ability to do that. And the other thing is they should have been doing it a long time ago. They recognized that the baby boom was going to be retiring, and part of it is averaging them in. But I would disagree, because in immigration, if the federal government is doing it correctly, they can allow the younger workers in.
But right now, the average age of a newly arrived immigrant is only in their 20s. So that's somewhat older than, somewhat younger than is the average age of a native-born American. But remember, just take the 2000 census. The average age of an immigrant in the 2000 census was 40 years, because the immigrants who we let in earlier had already aged. The average age of a native-born American in 2000 was only 36 years. And this just reminds us that immigrants age like everybody else. There aren't enough of them, and their fertility...
All right, we need to move on. Thanks very much for the call, John, as always. Let's go to another email. Professor Yale Lohr, let's give this one to you. On a practice point, the law in Arizona actually requires every person to carry documents of citizenship. That is very chilling. If you get stopped for a traffic issue, be prepared to prove you are a citizen. Maybe we should require some people to wear a star on their clothes to identify themselves.
Well, that's a concern of the Arizona law, is that nobody really knows what a reasonable suspicion is that allows a police officer to demand immigration documents. The law does have some provision saying that you cannot use simply race or color or national origin to stop someone. It also says that if a person has a valid Arizona driver's license or other identification license from Arizona, they are presumed to be lawfully present in the United States. But nevertheless, it's really going to come down to the discretion of the police officer, and I do worry about whether I'm going to have to start, you know, having my passport on me if I go to the gym in Arizona after this law takes effect, if it does.
Mm-hmm. So has there been a problem with people who are not here legally getting driver's licenses? I know that's been the case. There's been an issue, it was an issue in the last presidential campaign. Is that an issue in a lot of states? Can you do that in Arizona?
I don't know what Arizona law is. In New York, where I live, I know that they have cracked down, and right now you need to have a valid visa to show that you are legally in the United States. It's valid for more than 12 months before you can get a New York State driver's license. And I suspect that more and more states, under the Real ID Act or otherwise, are making it harder for people who are undocumented to be able to get a driver's license.
Right. Al from McHenry is our next caller. Hi, Al.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah. I want to applaud Arizona, because they're just doing what the federal government isn't, and they need to, because there are current laws that the federal government enforced that would cover this. You know, we have a law that, you know, do not let you hire illegal immigrants in the Social Security numbers, but they do nothing to enforce it once it comes back as a false number. They just tell the employer that, oh, well, you have the Social Security number doesn't match up. And this sets I don't blame the immigrant. If I was them, I would do the exact same thing. But this sets them up for exploitation, because let's face it, if the same employer will hire an illegal immigrant and break the law there, the labor laws don't mean that much to them either. You know, they don't care about overtime pay. They don't care about, a 40-hour work week and conditions. It's just unfortunate, and it has a domino effect through the schools, because now, unfortunately, many immigrant families live in large clusters in a home. So now the school doesn't get the tax money for that property, yet they have to educate more children per household. And typically these children also cost more to educate, because English is a second language, as Neil also pointed earlier. And, you know, I keep on hearing the slippery slope argument too, but I really don't see it. I mean, just because we want to enforce current laws doesn't mean we will take it a step further.
Okay, your phone is a little wobbly here, so let's get a response. Stephen Camerota, you want to start?
Well, I mean, the caller has a valid point.
this represents a policy choice. After 9/11, the Bush administration moved forward what was called a no-match letter policy. Social Security would inform employers that the worker that they were hiring, the name and number didn't match anything in Social Security's records. The business community was outraged. The Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and so forth, the Hotel and Restaurant Association, everybody complained, and so they worked on Republicans. On the left, the ACLU, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, and a whole bunch of others, and progressives in the Democratic Party worked against it, and what do you know, the Bush administration eventually abandoned the no-match letter, and it was in the courts at one point, and the Obama administration has just decided not to appeal. But that represented a policy choice. We could move to a situation where it was dramatically harder to hire illegals, but we've chosen not to as a society. And that's the important take-home point. We made a decision not to do it, at least here in Washington.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen, both so much. It is such a huge issue, isn't it? It just takes in so many things, jobs and humanity and families and fairness and unfairness. And ooh, it is big. Thank you both so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Our guest, Stephen Camerata. He is Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies and also Professor Stephen Yale Lohr, Adjunct Professor of Law at Cornell University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We were flooded with emails today, too, and I'm sorry we just didn't have enough time to get to any to all of them. We got to some of them, but not all of them. As you know, we'll be on this issue again, and we'll have a chance to hear more of your thoughts, more of your phone calls on where we go from here when it comes to immigration reform in this country. So that takes care of our first hour. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio. And yesterday we did a show on the middle-aged brain. It was a really interesting program for those of us who are middle-aged. It was quite reassuring. Today we're going to do another brain program and look at whether or not there are substantial differences between female and male brains. So stay tuned for more food for the brain coming up in just a moment.